Welcome, everyone. Today we're going to be looking at Chapter 9 and Chapter 10 from Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. We've got Craig, who will be leading today, so please support Craig, and any comments and any questions, any contribution that anyone would like to make. Chapter 9 is Germany from Kaiser to Hitler, 1913 to 1945, and Chapter 10 is Britain, the background to appeasement from 1900 to 1939. Okay, Craig, so I'm handing over to you. Welcome, Craig.
Okay, welcome, everybody. This is new for me. I don't normally do these sort of talks or even speak to people much. But I've been invited by Melissa, that hosts the cuttingthroughthematrix.com website. And they've made a book club here, and we're talking about the Tragedy and Hope book by Professor Carol Quigley. So like Alan would like to point out why these people are important. So it comes from, quick overview, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is from Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner Group, and these groups joined, and they tried to create a new British Empire, a new Commonwealth, and how would they be able to retain the power, and that was through free trade. So most people have probably heard of Chatham House rules. I don't know if that's sort of like taking the Chatham House rules, but the Chatham House rules are that anything that gets discussed within those walls could not be divulged outside of those walls. So it's secret. It's a secret club. And the reason that they do that is that they can speak about things that most people wouldn't even contemplate and don't even want to speak about. If you hear kids in the background, that's because we've got a couple of families here, and we're going to be tenting, camping out in the garden. So you might hear animals as well. Apologies for that. So I've been asked to do this talk, and to be honest, I do not know where to start. I haven't got a clue. So I thought I would start at why I am here. And the reason that I am here is because in 2020, early 2020, I heard all my countrymen, my patriots, and everybody around me laughing at all the Chinese and saying, oh, we're the West, we wouldn't ever do that, lock people down. And I said, oh, really? Okay. You really think that? So when they started locking people down and putting masks on children instead of burqas, because a lot of people before they were complaining about the Muslims, weren't they, putting burqas and covering people's faces, women and stuff like that. But now they found a new reason that they could justify themselves putting burqas and masks on children. So this is probably why a lot of people are here not understanding what has gone on, just absolutely confused. And oh my Lord, the Nazis might have won. So I don't know what page I should go to next. Here we go. Let's see. I've got so many notes here. The only reason that I am actually here is because I'm selfish. Because I want the best for my family. And I wouldn't be here. All my family was saying, oh, you're trying to save the world, Greg, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm trying to save me, my family. So all of us here, I would say, are on here for slightly selfish reasons, and we're trying to work out for ourselves what's going on and how we can operate in this world with good conscience. I've got so many pages here, I don't know what to go to next. Right, let's see here.
Can I ask you a question about your name, how you pronounce it?
Greg.
Okay.
But that's the Scottish accent. If you're from the US, it's Greg.
Okay. Well, I was trying. I was like saying Greg and but Greg. Okay. I'll try. You know, I think you just made a good point about how you got here and selfishness and caring about your family and your children. And one of the interesting things about the very beginning of chapter 9, which was Germany from Kaiser to Hitler, 1913 to 1945, is Quigley spent a lot of time talking about the tribal nature of the German people and how he's sort of blaming or talking, you know, maybe blame's not a good word, but he's presenting tribalness. They weren't part of the Holy Roman Empire, the West, that had long been, according to Quigley, civilized. So they were tribal. And I'm not, you know, Quigley obviously comes down on the side of civilization as a superior way of living, but I'm not sure tribal is all bad. And when I hear you talk about wanting to protect your family and your children, and this is why you want to learn, it's tribal behavior, tribal attitudes are, I think, primal until they're civilized out of us. So that's my two cents. Carry on.
Thank you, Melissa. That's it. That was one of the main points that when I read through this chapter 9. Yeah, you're right. The Quigley mentions the word tribal. I've actually noted it down to go into the meaning of it and the etymology of it. There's just too much, and I've not had time to go into it. But he mentions it a lot. The word tribal, tribalized, they lost their tribe. And I think it also mentions the breaking of the tribalization of Germany and then the quick succession of the Roman Empire, which was like an imperialist. The Germans like this imperialist type of rule. And so they had a double whammy. He actually called it a double trauma, heartbroken. He says, oh, I've just found it here, the Germanic tribe broken. And then from, I need reading glasses now. And from that, the Germans have not recovered today. And this is what Professor Quigley says. Yeah, this family-based, this community-based type of system, he is in the books, he's demonizing it. Tribal obviously means not civilized. As soon as you say a tribe, you think of people in the Amazon with just a loin cloth and a bow and arrow. So definitely, it's definitely got a mental type of thought that it's trying to project onto people. I would definitely agree. And where was I going to go from there? So, I mean, I've moved all over the UK and all over different parts of Europe, all over the world, to be honest. And everywhere that I have gone, there's just beautiful people that offer you their culture, the food, and how they live their lives. You definitely feel this bias and painting the picture of the villain from Quigley in this book. But I mean, that's normal in every book, I think, in every historic. You know, we all know that the winners sort of teach history. So, right, where am I going to go from here now? So, the reason, one of the main reasons that I am here is what happened. I actually got in contact with Alan, I think it was on the 22nd of February, 2021. And I said to Alan, I sent him a message because I'd been listening to his talks for about a couple of months. And I'd actually only got to Alan's talks because I'd been shouting out about this since the start of the Ovid. We'll try and make this YouTube friendly. YouTube, in Scotland, that's actually a an offensive term, YouTube. So I spoke to a friend and I was saying, I was telling everybody what he's doing, you know. So what a friend actually said to me, oh, you should listen to Alan Watts. This is, this 1970s guy that, you know, he reduces my anxiety a lot. So I said, okay, I'll listen to him. So I was listening to him and he did reduce my anxiety. He just flitted my mind away into oblivion. So I just gave all my responsibility away. Just like the Tao and the Tao and all these religions and everything that gives your responsibility away. So you don't actually have to do anything. You get an internal soul and, oh, you just, whatever it is, right now you don't have to do anything. Don't worry about it. So the one thing that I was then looking for more Alan Watts on torrent and I found one torrent. And it was Alan Watt. And I was like, oh, they've forgotten the S. So then I downloaded that and it was predictive programming. And that opened a whole can of worms for me. And that actually explained reality. It wasn't the reality that I wanted. It wasn't Santa Claus. It wasn't, but it was the truth. And it was, I understood that that was the truth. So that was quite profound for me. And that was, I ended up listening to a few, I listened to, I think his last two podcasts, which he did, which was the 4 hours and then four and a half hours. And I was just listening to him and he never stopped for a breath. I don't know if he even ever did any edits on those last two podcasts. Melissa, I think they were probably just.
I edited. Because those 4 or 5 hours, he was probably actually at the computer for 8 hours. He'd work on Saturday night recording and I'd sleep and then get up early Sunday morning and I'd edit. And he would, you know, take a break, get up, go to the bathroom, heat up some tea and then come back and start again. But the thing that always amazed me, whether he broke for coffee or tea, or just talked, you know, like even on an RBN 1 hour, is that the man never seemed to lose his train of thought. He could come, sometimes when I'd be editing or working on it, I'd be going along, he'd say something, but not complete the thought. And I'd be playing it along and 20 minutes later, I'd say, oh, Alan, you forgot to close that thought. And then boom, there he would. So. Amazing.
Yeah, it was very refreshing just to listen to somebody that, the biggest thing for me was he was able to point out, like, the Club of Rome. I'd never heard of that. I mean, I was brought up in the military and I've seen, just through my natural, life, I've seen all the BS and, going from different communities and the fashions and the fads. And so I've seen through all that, but I never read anything that. So as soon as I started getting interested and I listened to Alan, started hearing where it came from, the Club of Rome, the CFR, the, you know, this, you know, can show me, not just tell me, but give me the documentation that I, you know, wasn't saying, believe what I say. Here's the documentation. You go and read it yourself. And so I said, yeah, okay, well, I'm not going to believe you. I'll read it myself. I did have a cognitive dissonance about, because Alan would say the spraying is like bugs. I was like, oh, that might be a bit over the top, but, you know, I'm not going to throw it out. But then when the COVID came around and in Spain, I got there's a document and you can all look it up, SND/351/2020. So this is a document that was brought out by the Spanish government on the 16th of April in 2020, where they actually said that they were going to spray us with biocides using the technology of the Royal Air Force, their military air force, that could create, well, they said micro-nubilation, which is micro-clouds and clouds and stuff like that. So that, I was like, oh, well, that's that one blown out of the water as well, because now my government is actually telling me that they're going to use the technology that they've got to make cloud seedings, and they're going to actually spray biocides on us. So I went to the doctor and I said, see these biocides. Biocides, what does that mean? Is that like chemicals that kill biological material? You know, because I, you know, I'm biological, my son's biological. He might have an allergic reaction to that. Alan was one of the only guys, and I don't know if you picked up on the emails, that the email trail that sort of carried on with you, Melissa. The second time, then when I emailed Alan, it was actually the week of his death, so it was like I just found somebody that I could relate to and that I could speak to, and I actually mourned the day that he died more than, it was quite sad, quite profound. It was like losing a big brother. So it's.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, I think though there are a lot of people who have just discovered him since he's been gone, and even to have that little bit of that interaction, they'd go, oh wow, you know. But I understand the mourning. That was something that people from around the world also experienced. It's amazing how much he touched people and changed people, moved people in a completely different direction. In a way, it was like this huge loss for so many people, but whatever your belief system about what comes next or doesn't, to me, he's still very much here.
Oh yeah, definitely. So I can only imagine. Sorry, Frank. Go ahead, Frank.
Sorry, Greg, I didn't want to cut across you there. I would like to just simply identify with all of the lovely words that have been spoken here with respect to Alan. Indeed, in relation to a sense of mourning, by golly, I had it too. And I mean, I hadn't been listening to Alan for that long, maybe I'd say 2 years approximately. But anyway, Lord rest him. Could I just chip in on something here that I picked up with respect to Quigley? By jollity, he had some views on the chairman, so I'll put it that way. Just quoting from, I think it's page 411 in the book that I have here anyway, I'm assuming it's the same for everyone else. Quote unquote, what they, the Germans, have really wanted was coziness, freedom from the need to make decisions which require an independent, self-reliant individual, constantly exposed to the chilling breeze of numerous alternatives. How about that one?
Yeah, cheers, Frank. I mean, all through, there's so many quotes, I think, that we could quote for Quigley, disparaging, basically, my synopsis of the of this chapter is Quigley just absolutely slaughtering the German character, basically. I mean, this, another one, I've got a couple here. We in the West have escaped the fascination of totalitarianism because we, in our tradition, other elements, the refusal of the Hebrews to confuse God with the world, in religion with state, and the realization that God is transcendental. I need reading glasses. And accordingly, we with others must be in some degree incomplete and this imperfect. So this, and it's bringing down, this was one of the quotes that I like to quote, because this is like Alan was saying about the They're trying to show us that we are imperfect and that we need to improve ourselves. And there are a certain class of people that have gained the right through the Taoism mechanism to actually do that improvement. And there's another one here that I've got. During that 1,000 years, the West developed a pluralistic system in which the individual was the ultimate god, or the ultimate good, sorry, and the ultimate philosophical reality, faced with need to choose among many, an inflating allegiance. So the Germans, what they, in this chapter, they're trying to say that the Germans constantly need this authoritarian type of rule and their character from their tribalism, basically, you know, putting them down against the civilized West.
Sorry, I was just going to make a comment on that and the tribalism. One of the put downs that he said, he was talking about almost like a lack of maturity. First of all, he was elevating and talking about how the Western mindset brought about liberalism, you know, in geopolitics and individualism. And then he goes on to laud these things in the West. Individualism, he praises as bringing qualities like self-reliance with it. But when he's talking about the German, it's like he calls them children, like childish, have not, you know, the world revolves around them, all children, the world revolves around them, but there was no mechanism in German culture for them to overcome that. So they go out into the world very egocentric. And my first thought there was, I wonder what he thinks is the difference between someone who is highly individual and someone who is egocentric and thinks the world revolves around them. Then you're into nuance there. And it really was such character assassination of them. And then he said something about how the mindset made these people, what you were just saying about how they needed to be told what to do, you know, totalitarian, that there weren't any real businessmen who could grow up in that culture because, you know, business and capital and all that came from the highly individualistic mind. So it, at every turn in every way, he's doing this character assassination. And then the other thing that struck me, because I was fresh off of this conversation with Andrea for Real History, and she was talking about left brain and right brain. And so he talks about the West and separating Germany out of the West because they didn't have the benefit of coming up through the Holy Roman Empire, high civilization, etc. So the West has the not only individualistic mind, but it's rational. And he doesn't go on to say it, but many people have said about Germans that their mindset at that time, at least, was romantic or idealistic. So rather than that being, you know, if these things that he says are true about them, one could look at it as more positive aspects, just a different part of the brain being encouraged.
You know, Melissa, in relation to egocentrism, sorry, Greg, you know, I think he did claim at one stage, more or less, that the Germans were fond of wearing their qualifications on their sleeves, so to speak. And by way of indication of this, on page 414, quote unquote, in this system, the German feels it necessary to proclaim his position by verbal loudness, which may seem boastful to outsiders. Just as his behavior towards his superiors and inferiors in personal relationships seemed to an Englishman to be either fawning or bullying. All three of these are acceptable to his fellow Germans, who are eager to see these indications of his status as he is as much as he is to show them. All these reactions, criticized by German thinkers like Kant as craving for precedence and satirized in German literature for the last two centuries, have been the essential tissue of the personal relationships which make up German life. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. And what I mean, what Alan would say, I wouldn't like to put words in his mouth, but I think he would like to remind us that Carol Quigley was the CFR historian. He was an anthropologist, an anthropologic historian. So anthropology, what is anthropology? Anthropology is the study of populations. So most universities have got an anthropology department in all over the world. And so what are these departments? These are people that actually study the culture of the populations, their religions, the norms, what's allowable, what's not allowable. And these are the types of mindsets and the types of divisions within the university or a type of structure that they are militarized. This is the information that you need against your enemy to your enemy or your foe or the people that you want to take over their land and the power. This is the information that people use to get the upper hand. So Carol Quigley is just one of, for me, he's just one of these guys. He's like an MI6 agent, basically, isn't it? He's not 007 because he's not secret. But it's arming, it's a warfare. This is verbal warfare against different people. And his comparison, he disparages the tribal system and things like that. But his comparison is the West is imbued with an historical perspective and individualism. So this is his comparison against the German people and what we are like. And so this is him saying why we are not like them. But then the historical perspective, what is the historical perspective that everybody in the West has grown up with? That is just the indoctrination that you've got from your school. That's the history that the winners have told you. That's them painting and telling you what reality is. And individualism. I mean, they say we have individualism. What does that mean? Freedom of speech. So we're allowed to say what we want. You know, we've got all these great marketing terms. We're brilliant at marketing in the UK and the US. Free speech, freedom of speech. So what does that mean? Freedom of speech, individualism. Are you allowed to say what you want? Okay. Or except for this, this and this. And all it's like the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't know. So it's like forked tongue, isn't it? You can hear it. It's telling these are the bad people because they do that, and then we're the good people because you know, you've got all this indoctrination. You're individual. It ends up that he's basically talking about the same thing. It's just, and this comes back to like Bernays, isn't it? Even Bernays and his, with Freud, you know, and his propaganda, book that he wrote in the early 1900s, explaining that the way that you control people under a democracy, you give them their trends and you give them their culture and you tell them. And so they think that they're making the choices. So it's, you know, that's quite an interesting paradigm that basically everybody gets controlled. It just depends how you want to be controlled. And I'll need somebody to jump in here so I can find the next train of thought.
Well, those are good points. I think one of the things in this section that struck me was the quartet, the way that the system was organized there. You've got the monarchy up until 1918, and then you've got what Quigley called, maybe, I don't know, maybe others called it the quartet, but that was who had the power, the army, the landlords, which I don't know if you say it Junkers, but you've got the army, the landlords, the bureaucracy, and the industrialists. And one interesting thing he said was that there wasn't really infighting with these groups because they all kind of had the same outlook.
He also mentioned, Melissa, an outfit called the Free Corps, which apparently were made up by these types who would be selling their services to the highest bidder kind of thing. So it was an interesting kind of dynamic there within. He says, quoting from page 419, the quartet with the monarchy made the war of 1914-1918 and were incapable of winning it.
The quartet, so this is like the four legs of the government that Quigley's talking about, I think. And I mean, these four legs that he's talking about is the same four legs that we've all got in all different governments, I would argue. And I do have it actually noted down here. I've got so many different bits of scrap paper, I can't actually find it. But yeah, I think he had the government as the body, and then you've got the bureaucracy and the army and et cetera. I mean, we all live under now a system of bureaucracy. I think what's happened with, like, talking about the last chapter about socialism, the problem, like, with capitalism that I've seen, and I'm going to talk about a personal experience moving down from the UK down to Spain, is when I grew up, every shop had its shop owner, and it was the actual shop owner was there. So if you got a bad bit of fish, a bad bit of whatever, you know, bread, whatever, you went in and you spoke to the owner and said, oh, mate, look, you know, my kids are sick or whatever. So there was a sense of responsibility and actual wanting to keep your brand name and your business in a good light. But what we've all experienced now in the last 20, 30 years, I mean, your phone, your phone bill or whatever it might be, you phone up the company and you speak to the woman or you speak to the guy or whoever and you get irate and they're like, oh yeah, but it's not my fault. And you go, okay, well, whose fault is it? Who is responsible? So can you put them on the line, please? So this is, we've created and purposely created a system that creates everybody to act psychopathically, sociopathically. Even in the last job that I was in Holland, I was speaking to the guy and he's like, oh, it's just business, Greg. I'm like, well, it's not business because I've got to feed my kids. So this is, you know, we talk about the psychopaths. I was actually going to say Alan. I think Alan was probably a polymath and an empath. So he was on the correct path. But these other paths are on.
That's funny. That makes me laugh. I was going to hop over to the Weimar Republic because there was some point I wanted to make before we got out of this and moved too far down the line. He starts off, that's on my page 418. He said, it's the little section called the Weimar Republic. And he said, the essence of German history from 1918 to 1933 can be found in the statement, there was no revolution in 1918. For there to have been a revolution, it would have been necessary to liquidate the quartet, or at least subject them to democratic control. The quartet represented the real power in Germany, I think he means German society, but because they represented the forces of public order, army and bureaucracy, and of economic production, landlords and industrialists. Even without a liquidation of this quartet, it might have been possible for democracy to function in the interstices or interstices between them if they had quarreled among themselves. They did not quarrel because they had an esprit de corps bred by years of service to a common system, the monarchy, and because in many cases the same individuals were to be found in two or even more of the four groups. Franz von Papen, for example, was a Westphalian noble, a colonel in the army, an ambassador, and a man with extensive industrial holdings derived from his wife in the Saarland. Although there was no revolution, that is, no real shift in the control of power in Germany in 1919, there was a legal change. In law, a democratic system was set up. As a result, by the late 1920s, there had appeared an obvious discrepancy between law and fact, the regime, according to the law being controlled by the people, while in fact, it was controlled by the quartet. The reasons for this situation are important. I'm just going to read a little bit more and then I'll comment on it. He says, the quartet with the monarchy made the war of 1914-1918 and were incapable of winning it. As a result, they were completely discredited and deserted by the soldiers and workers. Thus, the masses of the people completely renounced the old system in November 1918. The quartet, however, were not liquidated for several reasons, which he went on to state. And for my purposes, I think I'm just going to mention the first two. The first was they were able to place the blame for the disaster on the monarchy and jettisoned this to save themselves. And two was that most Germans accepted this as an adequate revolution. Why that section was kind of important, he goes on to mention it again. He said that they were to blame for the war. The quartet, the old German system, there was no revolution because the quartet remained. And he then vilifies them even further, the German people, but in particular the quartet, but he, for the First World War. And the fact that they tried to scapegoat it on various things like international bankers, Jews, communism, etc. And I found it really interesting. I was reminded when I read that section of several pieces of historical fact, but they come together. There was an article that was, I looked it up this morning because I thought it was important, in a publication called The Millennium Report. And the title of the article was The NYC, New York City, the NYC and London banksters who financed the Bolshevik Revolution. And in that article, there were two things that they quoted in reference. One of them was something that Alan mentioned several times, was that Jacob Schiff, the German-American banker, had taken out a two-page ad in the New York Times in the spring of 2017 as a congratulation celebrating the overthrow of Nicholas II. That is a very important historical document that you see there, and the whole the convening of that. And then the article mentions another fact that Quigley would have been aware of, but he doesn't mention, which was Trotsky's My Life was published, I think, in 1930. And certainly Quigley would have read that. And it talks about where, you know, it alludes to where the money came from that financed him. And the article goes on to say, now there's dispute. It also quotes Sutton, Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And that was published in 1974. And I'm not sure when Quigley died. It might have been 73, but he certainly would have been aware, I'm sure, of Anthony Sutton and some of the work that he was doing, because, you know, Sutton was a well-known, respected historian. And so you're pointing to money that is financing this. And the article then finally said some of the money, some of the financing of the Russian Revolution can't be traced, but it is strongly believed in many quarters to have come from the German government. There's only a partial truth there when Quigley said that this quartet class were responsible for World War I, and that it was racist and vile of the ignorant German people to blame it on international bankers, Jews, and a few, you know, a handful of other culprits they needed. And he even goes to great length in this section to talk about where some of this, what he calls, you know, basically right-leaning or right politics propaganda was coming from, and completely omits the fact that there was money coming in from the West, that much of the money came from German-American Jews. There were other bankers, not all Jewish, but there were other international bankers who were financing it. The German government helped that. This wasn't just bumbling. This wasn't bumbling on behalf of the German government. The German government from many quarters at that time was the idea, I think, was to support them, to strengthen them. Pre this so-called revolution. Melissa, I think that, yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. I just wanted to strengthen what you were saying. I wanted to say something similar early on. Just remember that Quigley is educating a certain class of people for a task, and he's, when you've done a lot of study from other sources, you'll realize just how much that Quigley is omitting. And he's having a special go at the German character to, I think, deflect from all of the things that he should be inserting and neglecting to add. Also getting back to the quartet with the industrialists specifically, it wasn't so much that Hitler and the Nazis were running the state. There were three of, there was like a tripartite alliance in a sense. It was the Nazi party, it was the quartet. What was the fourth one? The state. Are those the three? And they had an uncomfortable alliance. They were sort of cooperating, but I think they were far more cooperative than we led to believe, because if you take a look at Hitler himself, he was acting really as a front man for the quartet. The quartet were really the ones that put him into power, and they were running the war through Hitler, who agreed to do it for them in a sense. So Hitler might have come out as a spokesman for the German people and said, it's the bankers and it's the this and the that. But meanwhile, the bankers, both American and German, both from the quartet and from the American industrial capitalist side, they were all funding him. You know, so when he was speaking up against the Jewish bankers, whatever it is, it's all just a big con, all a big game. The book Trading with the Enemy points out that the American business sector, the large industrial giants like Ford and Chevrolet, you know, without them, the Germans wouldn't have had militarized vehicles for the war, and neither would the Russians. It was quite funny because you had broken down vehicles in the war on both the Russian and the German side. And when you looked at some of the parts underneath the bodywork, you would find Ford engines or Ford or Chevrolet components. So there you had, you know, Ford. I think Ford had a factory in Germany. But, you know, at a higher level, the whole war was completely orchestrated from the likes of the people that Quigley is claiming to represent their history, but he's omitting so much. I think the reason why this book, Tragedy and Hope, was censored was that it simply raised too many questions, because Quigley was a professor and an historian for the Council of Foreign Relations and their whole, everything associated with them. So if you had new members coming in, studying the history that they were given, the formal, the syllabus that they are supposed to pass through, I think Quigley was confusing issues for them. And that's why higher ups tried to crush Quigley's work. Because you have to have people coming in through the system that believe very, very much in the righteousness of the enterprise, the global effort being made by the Council of Foreign Relations. And Quigley's work, Tragedy and Hope, puts a little bit of a spanner in the works. So when I read what Quigley's writing about Germany, about the war, about the various participants, you got to throw salt. You got to constantly pinch, you know, a bit of salt and throw it over your shoulder all the time, because he's telling you a certain amount of truth, but he's omitting so much as well. And I think that's why he went after the German character so much. It's to divert responsibility from the quartet, to divert responsibility from foreign players that, you know, quickly sort of providing cover for a whole lot of people.
Sorry, Greg. Just very quickly, in the quartet, as far as I can recall anyway, it seems that there were two main beneficiaries from Tiny Mustache Man. One was the industrialists, and the other were the Junkers, the landlords.
Okay, was that it? Yeah.
You always make me laugh, Frank, the Tiny Mustache Man.
I just took a bite of a hot dog there, so you have to excuse me. What I would like to say, I would like to double down on what Darren says about Quigley, double talking. If you look at the objectives, what was the objectives of the Germans, the Nazis, in the Second World War? I would argue it was to unify Europe under one control, where Germany was the master. Germany was the controller. I've been posing the question to many Europeans now, how are we not in that situation now with the EU? That all of Europe has to listen to the Commission and the ECB, the European Central Bank is in Germany, that prints all the euros. So I don't know if Hitler would actually be, would Hitler actually be that disappointed with the situation that we're in now? If anyone would like to make comment on that.
Was Hitler's last name von der Leyen by any chance?
That joke went over my head. Sorry, Frank, I might be a bit young for that, but sorry, anybody else?
Yeah, Greg, I agree with you completely. That was the overriding point of World War II. World War I initiated an enormous change in identity amongst Europeans, but it wasn't enough. They needed a World War II. So you can see how the banking, money, financial, world banks, et cetera, built up tensions, how they created a situation where one default and the whole system sort of falls backwards on itself, like a set of dominoes, with nobody wanting to lose in the process. And so they manufactured and set up World War II because they did want to bring in a European Union. And that was the goal, as we know. The insight that we get from Tragedy and Hope is how they did it to some degree without a person, an author like Quigley, saying so. Because we'll never ever get a confession from these people. We know that. But being widely read and getting the data in over the history from different sources, we know that it wasn't organic. It was orchestrated. You follow the money. You follow the international connections between the bankers and the industrialists. You can see that, you know, the the face value history that the public have given is completely and utterly false. We know that, as quickly mentioned, that war is used to accelerate a social change, a political, geopolitical change. So we see a union coming out of World War II. If you look at what Quigley is saying about the quartet, the roles that the industrialists played, even the history that he's giving is, he's pretending that a whole lot else didn't happen. And the history that he's given doesn't quite make sense. He makes World War II and the German situation within World War II sound very domestic. He's trying to sort of hide the fact that a larger union was on the go. Yeah, I think I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, cheers, Davin. Yeah, so, I mean, basically, Quigley is here telling us and decimating the German character, explaining why the tribalism. See, one of the actual points earlier on in the ninth chapter, his reference of the tribalism is the 12th century poem, the Nibelungenlied, if I said that right. But this is one of the basis of the tribalism going through all the German people. And it might be true, it might not be. I've not gone through, I can't even speak German, so I couldn't critique, I couldn't critique it enough to tell you. But what I can say is, when I looked on, I looked at this poem, just on Wikipedia, and it was actually, it was named as a part of the Memory of the World program. I was like, what's the Memory of the World program? So this is the UNESCO, which is Julian Huxley, the UNESCO project, and this is their quote, safeguard the documentary heritage of humanity. So that's, they're using, he's got authority to put these, there must be thousands, hundreds of thousands of texts and whatever points of view, but these people are just picking out the bits that they want to put in to describe people how they want them to be described in the future in this blockchain, probably Memory of the World program. For me, that is, it's unbelievable. It's like, who gave you that job? No, you don't have the right to do that, to choose. So this is what we're fighting against. These people that believe that they've got the authority to make up acronym institutions and names because they've got money behind them. And they dictate what's true and what's not true, what's history and what's not history. It's absolutely frightening. So I think that's why a lot of people have waken up and coming onto these programs and speaking about it, which we all need to do. So if someone wants to jump in and then I can get my next train of thought. Thank you.
I'm wondering if we want to leap ahead. I don't know how you felt, Greg, but about all of the politics leading up to Hitler and the what percentage were what party, but I wasn't particularly interested in that unless somebody else has some thing to add about how, you know, how the Nazis finally got to power. Maybe we can just talk a little bit about the Nazi regime.
Melissa, I think we had reference to a military or paramilitary outfit called the SA. And I know Hitler himself formed the SS, which was their own kind of security detail. But the SA were the brown shirts, I think. And in their methodology, the general methodology to eventually get power, it was like a twofold clamping sort of movement. They used the SA as the brutes, if you like, the brute force. They went out and, you know, the night of the long knives kind of thing, or Kristallnacht, wasn't that what they called it? Something like that. And then they also used, the legal system, pushing down from the other side, squeezing all of the opposition eventually out of the way until Hitler eventually in 1933, after a few bit of kind of ups and downs in terms of Nazi representation within the Bundestag, finally got the go, if you like. And he got that, I think, as a result of speaking in favourable terms in front of mass gatherings of the industrialists and the industrialists, but also to the landowners, to the Junkers, as they call them. Okay?
I've got a little message from Andrea. She can't speak. Her computer's got a problem with the speaker and the microphone. She just wanted to bring to our attention that we've gone on an hour now, and we would be safe if we sort of went on for another half an hour.
Damn computers.
If there's a burning issue we want to talk about the Nazi regime, because a lot of this is organization, et cetera, do we want to just jump into Britain, the background to appeasement?
Well, that's fine. You guys are going to have to lead that, because I never actually got that far. I've been traveling like the last 10 days. So what I did want to say was one of the reasons that a lot of us are probably here is because when all this started in 2020 and the people started to act like Stasi and Nazi, because I've put on my Facebook, I couldn't understand why the German people acted the way that they did. But I tell you what happened to us in the last 4 years, I can understand exactly what happened to those people.
Yeah, just chipping in, I only got an opportunity to read Chapter 9, so I don't know anything relative to Chapter 10 yet.
I looked over quickly, it's basically the Balfour Declaration, isn't it? His uncle was actually the Prime Minister for 8 years before John Balfour was, so, and he made the declaration for... What was that for? That was for the Israeli settlement.
I found the beginning of Chapter 10 to be very interesting, where he discussed different, you know, I don't know very much about the British parliamentary system. And so I found this educational, and I also found some of the comments that he made comparing it to American politics to be interesting, especially that in the, well, I don't know, almost 60 years since he wrote this book, that I would say some of the things that he says about American politics were probably true then, but are not now. Things have changed. We've devolved in a way. But if we wanted to, we might call a reconvene on Chapter 10 for, say, a week from today. And would that work for you, Greg?
Yeah, that would be great, because this week I could actually sit down and put time aside and actually put some proper notes, because I'm just all over the place here, to be honest. And I'm sorry if it hasn't been a good enough to, well, not good enough, but the same talk as normally. I had different plans for what we could talk about, but there's so much we could talk about, to be honest. I think we could have been here 10 hours. So
you've done just fine. Absolutely. And I think that we all agree that each one of these chapters or two chapters together, we could just go on and on, because there's so much there. And it is interesting to continue to bring it up into the present day. So you've done just fine, but I'm thinking that considering we've been going for an hour and we'd love for you to lead this one, that you can take the week and we can come back and then we'll all pitch in on our, what we have to say about Chapter 10. Does the group say, does someone second my motion?
Melissa, yes.
Yes. I second that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been traveling the whole of this week as well, that I never got into my reading like I should have. So, Chapter 10, I would need another week. That would be great.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, Melissa, for talking, and I'll do a better job next week, I promise.
And no need to apologize. There's no, absolutely nothing but praise and appreciation. You've done great, and I just think there's always so much to cover, and I will say, since you said at the beginning that we're all here for selfish reasons, I'm going to admit a bit of selfishness. When I have an hour to illustrate for a video, it just goes so much quicker. So I can illustrate this one and have it up the first of next week, and then we can reconvene maybe same time next week.
I just wanted to add one last thought with regards to the chapter we've been reading, and it's what Frank brought up with regards to Russia. Do you see the similarity between the consolidation of power of Hitler with what happened in the Russian Revolution, after the Trotskyists came into power, and then how they were undermined, and how everyone that assisted Lenin eventually had a bullet in the back of their head. We see the same pattern, the exact same pattern almost, with the Nazis, and yeah, a lot of people that were quite close to Hitler in the Nazi party were...
Arkansided?
A lead sandwich, you know. So
yeah,
it's interesting how that works. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Greg. Thanks, everyone.
Well, yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Much appreciated.
Oh, before we go, may I say something? We'll reconvene next Saturday. Is that the third? Of the third. Yeah, okay. Okay. But I think, for the group, I mean, we all have chapter 10 to either read or brush up on, but our next, let's think about this. I personally think that for the month of August, if we just do the one chapter, chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, that is enough. It's a shorter section than we've done. It's a little over, it's almost 60 pages. And we've been doing about 100 at a time, but I think that in the dog days of summer, that's a good goal. Do we agree?
Absolutely, Melissa. I think going one chapter at a time is a way better proposition.
Okay. All right. So we will come back next week, at the same time, same channel, for chapter 10, and then I'll announce on the Redux and any other avenue that the reading for August is chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns.
And Melissa, while we all are here, would anyone like to volunteer for chapter 11? Frank?
Frank?
Are you volunteering?
Yes.
Oh, you smart cookie, you.
It's what we call it, Hitler style volunteering.
I'll go on and say hi then.
And so what one, I'd like to close out this conversation, and Melissa, you can close this out with, this was brought to you from cuttingthroughthematrix.com. That is cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And there's also, sites at .net, .us. And .ca. I think, well, you've got Odyssey as well, odyssey.com/@AlanWatts, Alan and Watt is capitalized, and then CTTM for Cutting Through the Matrix. I think Twitter, you've got AlanWatt_CTTM as well. I think you do actually have, the Sentinel. I heard you had problems with the Sentinel, the EU, websites, that they might be clamping down on. Can you give us a bit of info on that? Because the walls are closing in.
This is a bureaucracy thing with the EU and content and censorship, and it's ongoing. I did not think it would take this long. And I upload, every time I put something up, I upload it to Sentinel. So it's still being up maintained and updated, and it's up to date. It just can't be publicly seen.
Okay, thanks.
So, But there's also, thanks for shouting out all of the other things. There's rumble.com/C/AlanWattCTTM2 and CTTM. and BitChute. You can go to the cuttingthroughthematrix.com and see all kinds of ways to connect and see content. And I appreciate everybody participating in this. I just think that what we're doing is a really good thing. I have to say one more thing. If anybody has been listening to some of the real histories that I've done, you might remember that I spoke with Prince a couple of months back or so. And I got a note from him a couple of weeks ago because we were discussing what might be next year's book club. And he said, Alan Watts Cutting Through Books should be the next book club. And I thought, yep. Well, duh.
That was the last plugs that I was going to say, Alan. I wrote to you and I actually said that I wanted to buy those books, and I've still not been managed to get those books manuscripts. So Alan wrote three different books. If you want to shout them out, I know one was The Miracle Los Milagros in Spanish. If you want to shout them out, and if you go to cuttingthroughthematrix.com, you can buy and order any of these online through Stripe. Thanks.
Waiting for the Miracle is, that is a great book form, transcript form of the Ancient Religion, Ancient History talks that he did with Jackie Petru, which are not on the website. So those are only available in disc or book form at this point. And for those, I actually have them in Spanish, Portuguese, and just now, brand new, in German. So that's those books. And then the Cutting Through volumes 1, 2, and 3. The first volume is The Androgynous Hermaphroditic Agenda, to which when I first came on Alan's work, I said, huh? And so that's how far we've gotten. He wrote that in 1999. So he was definitely, he could see that coming. And then volume 2 is called A Glimpse into the Great Work. That was also 1999, and volume 3 is Esoteric Unveiled and the Meaning of Revelations in the High Masonic Tradition from 2003. So those are available individually, or they're spiral bound together as one set. And I think I had, I know what I was going to say about that and why it would be great to do book club is that I don't know how many times I've read those books, but I promise you that every time I pick up Alan's books, I learn something. I'm prompted to think deeply on something or reevaluate what I was thinking before or go look something up. And I'll never be an expert on his books. I will always be a student and learning. But I think it's, book club is a great form in which to get other people's feedback and learn from each other. So that is it for me. Otherwise, I'll be illustrating a really long video. So I think I'll be back next week for chapter 10 and Greg leading chapter 10.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you,
everyone. Tonight. We'll see you.
I'm going to keep the video on just so that I can download it, but I will stop the recording now. Thank you, guys.